Good morning and welcome to this February 10th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on how to access those later in the hour. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors not only about their books, but about their writing process, creativity, craft, all of those things that go into creating compelling fiction and occasionally nonfiction, poetry, short stories. It's my pleasure this morning to welcome Jan Martel, and in the second half, British novelist Tessa Hadley will be on with her latest novel, The Past, so stay tuned for that. But first, Jan. Jan Martel is the author of The Life of Pi, the global bestseller that won the 2002 Man Booker Prize, among other honors, and was adapted to the screen in the Oscar-winning film by Ang Lee. He's also the author of the short story collection, The Facts Behind the Helsinki I'm going to say this wrong, but it's Rocamaccio's, perhaps, the novel Self and Beatrice and Virgil, and the nonfiction work 101 Letters to a Prime Minister. It is his latest novel that we're talking about this morning, The High Mountains of Portugal. Jan was born in Spain. He studied philosophy at Trent University, worked at some odd jobs before traveling widely and turning to writing. He lives in Canada, but he joins me this morning from his book tour in San Francisco. Jan, welcome.
Good morning, Marie.
Good morning. All right. I really enjoyed this book. I want to, before we dive into it, give you a chance to sort of take us into it, introduce us to the book, and give our listeners a little preview here.
Sure. It is a novel, but a novel in three distinct parts. So some people have started calling it a three novellas. But in fact, it is a novel just in three distinct parts, each connected by the same theme. An event that happens in part one echoes throughout the rest of the novel. It's sort of like a palimpsest, what you read in parts two and three. What happens in part one will show through in parts two and three. So it is a novel, but in three distinct parts. First one features a road trip through Portugal in 1904. Second one features a pathologist who has a very long night. Two women come to see him, to talk to him. The first his wife, the second a peasant woman. His first wife has a curious theory linking the Gospels with Agatha Christie, the murder mysteries of Agatha Christie. And part three is a story of a Canadian senator, and a Canadian senator is far less empowered than an American senator, who retires to that same area of Portugal with a chimpanzee. And this takes place in the 1980s. So three distinct stories, all linked by the same theme. And I would say that The High Mountains of Portugal is like Life of Pi, a literary exploration of religion, of faith. And I say literary in the sense that it's not a faith-based exploration. It is a literary exploration of it. I've been intrigued since Life of Pi by that curious phenomenon called faith, which really goes against the grain of our modern ethos, of our age of reasonableness, of the triumph of technology, of medicine, and all that. Those are all based on close attention to detail, and faith isn't like that. That faith is something you do that goes beyond what we can reasonably prove. It's not empirical. It's not verifiable, or not verifiable in a way that's reproducible, like science. So it intrigues me why people still have commit acts of faith. Some we think are quite obvious, like a romantic love. We don't really question, we do it because it feels so good. Religious faith goes beyond that. So I've been intrigued by it. So this is another literary exploration of that.
I love these themes that sort of plague an author for their entire life, and you can watch them take, you know, kind of runs at it in different angles and grapple with it in different ways. And I mean, that's really been an enduring theme of your work throughout. Am I right in saying that this novel was on your mind since Life of Pi, that you had wanted to write a novel about Portugal in the 1930s for quite some time now?
Even before that, you're right that in the author's note of Life of Pi, the author says that he means to work on a novel set in Portugal when he goes to India. Sorry. But in fact, in my early 20s at university, I started work on a novel set in Portugal. Why Portugal? Because it was the first country I traveled on my own. It was the first time I was a lone, solitary element in a completely alien reality. I'm Canadian. I don't speak Portuguese. I had lived in Europe before. I lived 4 years in France as a child. This is my first time all alone exploring that foreign reality, and it's a very bracing experience. It had made a deep impression on me. And so in my early 20s in university, when I got back to university, I tried to write this novel set in Portugal, but I didn't know how to do it. I was too immature as a person, as a writer, as an artist. So I put it aside, and then I tried it again when I went to India, but it didn't work out, so instead I wrote Life of Pi. And finally, I think I managed how to do it in the last few years.
I love it. The other thing that reverberates throughout this novel is the notion of grief. And at the center of all three of these sections, someone has lost someone important, either a spouse, always a spouse, and in another story, a child. And I think it's a really interesting question of whether it's possible to prepare for grief in advance, whether it's possible to sort of rehearse grief. And having never suffered a really major grief in my own life, I find myself doing this sort of, you know, if I go through every possibility, when the scenario happens, will I be better prepared for it? And I was wondering if you've had that thought too, that if I do this enough, maybe when something terrible happens, I'll be better prepared.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that is the role of fiction, in a sense. We do in fiction what we don't want to experience in reality. And I think religion, which of course has many negative aspects, I'm not defending those at all, but it's more positive aspects, it is a preparation for our deaths. Religion talks all the time about death, but not in a morbid context, in a context of it is death that gives meaning to life. Life only makes sense if you're aware of its finality. So I think it is exactly that I do write about what I write, because I'm like you, I've never experienced any major loss, but having studied philosophy, having traveled, having read books, I'm aware that tragedy is just around the corner. One of the characters says, the wife of the pathologist says at one point in part three, we all live a murder mystery of which we are the victim. At the end of it, life will murder us, and you might as well elucidate that mystery before you get there. So I do believe in the preparation that art and that religion can give you. And it's not just sort of a self-help kind of preparation. It really does give your life a different tone, a different color, if you're aware that it is fleeting. And also the other thing, too, is that in explaining your end, it also gives color to your journey to that end. That's what I love about religion. And I once again mean it's benign manifestations, is that it infuses life with a sense of wonder, which excessive reason can stamp out. If you're excessively reasonable, that tends to scour away, obviously, at religion, but also even at the wonder that art can communicate. And that's what I noticed myself. Having studied philosophy at university, I was becoming too reasonable. It was scouring away at the wonder of life, and I reconnected through that, through these explorations of religion. And I say that whether people have any kind of faith or not. The point of faith isn't that whether it's certain or not. It's just that you speak that language, that you entertain its possibilities, and whether they're factually true or not, it can't be proven. So it's kind of beside the point.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think that's also the power of storytelling to each other. There's a really wonderful passage I didn't ask you to read before we got on the air, so now I'm really putting you on the spot. But if you happen to have the book, there's a really wonderful passage on page 155 where you talk about the power of storytelling through religion and really what the benefit of these stories is to in a comforting way or in a way of understanding sort of our place on the planet.
You know what, I travel light, so as a matter of fact, I don't have a copy of the book, so all I can say is that section that you're mentioning, the reader will have to imagine it and try to find it for herself or himself. Sorry, I don't have a copy.
Let's all turn to page 155.
There we go.
But I think that's an incredibly interesting notion. And the other
thing... It's always struck me that religion is inherent to religion is storytelling. And to give a contrast, you know, science is not necessarily narrative. Of course, there's a continuity to science. You know, Einsteinian physics is built upon Newtonian, but it's not necessarily narrative. The only thing that counts in science is the latest discovery. Anything else is the history of science, which is something very different from science itself. So it's not necessarily narrative. And any anecdotes, any sort of colorful things about science, like, you know, Newton's apple and all that, those are just anecdotes. Whereas religion is profoundly narrative, and also profoundly personal. It's interesting. Science is completely impersonal. The truths of science, and they are truths, are there regardless of whether there's a subject observing them or not. Whereas in religion, the individual, any individual, the smallest, most disempowered person on earth, matters directly to religion, to the concept of religion. And that, I find, is also very interesting, that storytelling is linked to the individual.
Yeah, right, right. One thing that struck me, there's an autopsy section in section two that gets it. I don't want to give too much away, but it gets a little bit into magical realism. And I was thinking that magical realism in your work is a really wonderful way to expose emotional truths that feel right, that you know otherwise wouldn't actually occur in reality. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the role of magical realism in your work, and if you feel like you can get to things that you can't otherwise.
Well, I'd just say the role of magic, to me, that's what fiction is great at. It gets at truths that nonfiction can't get at. Nonfiction is tethered to facts, and that can be its strength, but also its limitation. We can go with our empathetic imagination to places where we can't go factually. And I'll very quickly give you a very, very concrete example. There's the Israeli novelist David Grossman, who wrote a novel called Sea Under Love, and it's his way of dealing with the Holocaust. And there's a scene in a camp where a Jew who cannot die, he cannot be killed off, he clearly symbolizes the immortal spirit of Judaism crossing the time, and he ends up in a gas chamber. And because he cannot die, once they open the chamber, the Nazis, they find him still standing there. So he witnesses something that no one has ever witnessed. No one has actually survived being inside the gas chamber. So David Grossman went with his empathetic imagination, where no historian, no journalist, no Jewish witness in the camps, no Nazi guard could ever go. And he got criticized for that. Some people saying, you can't go there. In a sense, he was invading a sacred space that should be left beyond words. And, you know, he defended himself, and I agreed with him that, you know, that's exactly the role of fiction, is to go by surprising means, to go to places where we can't actually go ourselves. But because it's carried by the wings of empathy, it brings back truths that are not factual truths, but are nonetheless human truths, existential truths, psychological truths. That's what fiction is great at. It can address all kinds of truths, of which factual truth is just one aspect, just the starting point.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I do think in many ways fiction is more true than, we discussed this a lot on the show, than nonfiction, and because of that very point. And this might be a good time to talk a little bit about what makes that magical realism work. We don't talk a lot about it on the show, sort of this genre, and what kind of the rules are to let the reader follow along. Is it just that you have kind of an emotional hook to keep the reader with you, are there rules that you kind of follow to make this work so well?
No, I don't follow rules. In fact, I don't really know what I'm doing. I just do things that feel right. I think magical realism has, you know, technically as that term is usually applied, you know, is exactly that, a mix of magic and of realism. And I think it partly works because you anchor yourself in the realism, and then there's these poetic flights that, as I said, poetically get to a greater truth. Now, in my novels, I think it's slightly misapplied to me. I don't mind it, but it's sort of they're trying to pigeonhole me, and I don't particularly mind because it's a good term. I don't mind being in the company of the great magical realist, but I don't think I quite fit. So, in Life of Pi, there in fact is nothing that's magical realist. There are certainly things that are implausible, but they're not technically magical. I mean, you know, algae does exist. There are meat-eating plants. There are plants that can filter out salt out of the water. So, now in this one, in the high mountains, you're right. The autopsy has elements that are flights of fantasy, rooted in a reality, the reality of an autopsy. So there you're right, it would be more properly magical realist. And there I did it, though I often do these things, for symbolic, for allegorical reasons. The autopsy is there for a purpose. What is found in the body of this dead man is meant in allegorical terms. You're supposed to sort of figure out why there is what there is. It's supposed to be a mystery that I hope connects with the reader. Mm-hmm. While something's being figured out quite concretely, other just supposed to be sort of a mystery. That's the whole point of art, is to jolt the intake of that art, whether it be a book or music or a film, to imbue them once again with the sense of wonder. See, that is the one thing with reason, is as much as it is given us, it tends to limit us from these flights of fantasy. And life is profoundly subjective. Life really is how you interpret it. And it's totally fine to inject that with a degree of fantasy, with a degree of non-literal truth. All the stories we say, all the sort of personal stories, family stories, national stories, are all a blend of fact and fiction. And that is the true final account of life, are these, you know, mixture of magical realist interpretations of life. That really is what life is finally about.
Right, right. I love it. My guest this morning is Jan Martel. The book is The High Mountains of Portugal. The great thing about this is, and I think this is not giving anything away, is that there actually are no high mountains of Portugal, that they're really kind of lowland flat rolling hills.
Yeah, well, and that's true. And here's a good example of sort of a kind of magical realism. That's true. There are no high mountains. Two characters in the novel observe when they finally come there and say, well, that's bizarre. There are no high mountains there. There's no alpine summits. There's no snow. There's nothing. And that's actually based on a fact that there is in the northeast of Portugal an area called Trás os Montes, which means beyond or behind the mountains. And there are no mountains. And even odder is that when they named the place that, it wasn't even the mountains that concerned them, these imaginary mountains. It was beyond them. Mm-hmm. So it always struck me there, when I first visited Portugal, when I visited that region, I realized that, in a sense, geography, or specifically toponymy, the naming of places, is an act of storytelling. Mm-hmm. We describe landscapes, we name them in ways that they can belong to us, they can start being familiar to us. We make ourselves at home by naming places. And it is a kind of storytelling. And so this idea of calling a place beyond the mountains, where there are no mountains to start with, really struck me, hence the title of my novel. And you're right, emphatically, there are no high mountains, so clearly they are mountains in the mind. They are magic mountains. They are mountains that we climb in our hearts, in our mind. They're aspirational mountains.
Right, right. Let's talk a little bit about putting the novel together. As you mentioned at the beginning of the show, it's constructed in three parts, and some people have sort of called them more linking novellas than a novel, and I really like this play with structure. So when you were setting out to write it, what was your point of entry? Did it begin with a character? Did it begin with this three-part structure? Talk a little bit about getting into it.
I never start with character. Character puzzles me. Most of my narrators tend to be fairly benign, perhaps even passive, and so they are not extraordinary. What's extraordinary is what happens to them. So I always hope that my narrators are like people you step into a car with, and they're the driver, and you sort of observe what they see, and together extraordinary things happen. So a perfect example would be Pi, who I suppose is unusual to Americans being Indian and practicing three religions, but other than that, he's sort of a kind, open character, and hopefully you'll just look out the window as he drives the car with you. So character to me basically comes last. I'm primarily motivated by certain ideas. Each book that I've written has been an attempt to explore a question. So my first book, and I'll help you with the pronunciation, which no one can get, is The Facts Behind the Helsinki Rockamadios. Okay. I invented this Italian name, which of course is a completely not Italian name, doesn't exist. In that collection of stories, I was exploring what stories are, what they do, how they function. In my second book, which was a novel called Self, which wasn't published in the U.S., I posit a character who, while he's traveling in Portugal on his 18th birthday, turns into a woman, and is a woman for 7 years, and then switches back to a man as a result of a rape. And there I was exploring, you know, gender identity. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? To the extent that we think about it and we're aware of it, what do those two mean, and how does that map over sexual orientation? Because my male character, when he becomes a woman, she is a woman in form, but she's still imbued by her male heterosexual upbringing, so she's initially attracted to women. And so it feels totally natural to her to kiss a woman. And then slowly she sort of drifts, her desire drifts towards men. And the first time she kisses a man, the thought that pops into her head is, I am gay, even though on the outside she's doing a banally heterosexual act. So sort of exploring the idea of the body being an environment, and it yields us to certain tendencies in our behavior and our thinking, which of course can be overridden. But anyway, so that was an exploration of that. In Life of Pi, I was exploring the meaning of religion. What is religion? What is faith? How does it work? What is its relationship to storytelling? So each one was an attempt, each version was an attempt to understand the Holocaust. Why do we limit it? Why do we represent it in such limited ways? Always, always social realism. Nothing wrong with social realism, with historical realism, but why does that mode of representation dominate every other representation of the Holocaust? So each one was an attempt to explore something. And in this one, I was, in a sense, as I said, it's another literary exploration of religion. I was looking at the different relationships one might have with an object of faith. And it's, once again, I choose religion. It could be any faith, romance. It could be faith in a loved one. It could be faith in Bernie Sanders, in a football team, whatever. It doesn't matter. It's just, how do we live with our faith? How does our faith help? If we suffer, how does our faith help? So in a sense, that sort of driving intellectual point was my starting, was my where I started. And from there, I used story to try to help me understand that. And in this case, I had certain ideas that came from my early 20s when I started that novel. Things added themselves. For example, the insight about the murder mysteries of Agatha Christie and the Gospels, that just came to me. My process of writing is I have a little tiny idea, and I don't have many ideas, but I work them. And I work them in part by doing research. So, and my research will tend to give me new ideas. And then new ideas gives me avenues for research. And so what I do, and Life and Pi is the best example of that, is I write notes, and these are notes I write quite spontaneously. They will be little ideas, turns of phrases, little scenes, information on certain factual things, like, let's say, the turtles of the Pacific. I eventually print those up, and I have, let's say, maybe 400 pages of them, and I cut them up and put them in different envelopes, depending on where they belong in a novel, in the novel, and then I just start writing the novel from first part to the end part, and each of those envelopes is the backbone of that novel. Structures that section. Some parts in the snippets I will use, others I won't, but they will basically be the backbone of that chapter, and that guides me, because I'm certainly incapable of just sitting down and writing a novel. I need to be carefully guided. So it's a very sort of slow, incremental, organic process, along which there are definitely ideas. So, for example, in Life of Pi, people remember when they arrive on the coast of Mexico and the tiger, Richard Parker, just leaves. That, you know, I knew in that chapter that, you know, they would separate. But I hadn't really thought of how they would separate, and that arose just spontaneously when I was writing that section. It felt natural that the tiger wouldn't say goodbye. So the discoveries along the way, but my trip is carefully planned. So that's how I've written The High Mountains of Portugal, too. I did my research, of course, on autopsies. I saw two autopsies in Saskatoon, where I live. I did research on primate behavior, on automobiles. I went twice to Portugal. That, you know, nourished my ideas, made them deeper, broader, and so that's how I wrote. And literally how I write, well, I write very, very slowly. I'm not a natural writer. I don't write in paragraphs. I write in sentences, word by word. It's like a bricklayer. It's one brick at a time. But I sort of enjoy that process. It's not one. I sort of enjoy the painstaking way I write. I take my time. I have the luck, thanks to the success of Life of Pi, to not be pressed by other demands on my time. I can devote myself to it. And so I take my time.
Right. In writing in the aftermath of Life of Pi, is it difficult to sit down at the blank page again thinking, okay, now there's this weight of oppression of this, you know, big bestseller out there? Do you just kind of leave that behind?
First of all, the success of Life of Pi was such a freak success. It is such an odd book. It's a book about, you know, zoology and theology. And it's the book that has done well. It's the book that has gone on to sell, you know, forever. And that's on the outside of my studio. When I close the door, you know, when I'm sitting down, there's no tiger in my office. There's no reader in my office. There's just me. And the success of Life of Pi, my perspective on that is the success of a book doesn't improve you as a writer, actually. It does, yes, make you more confident. But really, when you're a writer, you're basically, it's a universe of two things. You, the writer, and you, the reader. You're the first reader. So I loved Life of Pi, but I also loved my other books. Beatrice and Virgil had very mixed reviews. Some people absolutely hated it. In fact, the guy from the Washington Post who liked The High Mountains called Beatrice and Virgil, in that same positive review of The High Mountains, he called it cringe-inducing. You don't want to hear, you know, being cringe-inducing. Well, I love Beatrice and Virgil. It satisfied me, what I was trying to do. So in that intimate relationship in my studio, what's happened outside before is of no consequence. I would say that a success doesn't improve you as a writer. Your strengths remain the same and your weaknesses. I'm still sort of applauding word-by-word writer. Having had a success with Life of Pi doesn't mean that I can suddenly write entire paragraphs. And its success also, I'm still aware of my strength, and I quite like the ideas I discuss. They satisfy me. As I said, Beatrice and Virgil was torn to shreds by some quarters. I'd still be totally happy to talk to them about it and explain what I was trying to do and, in a sense, question them and say, why do you question your suppositions? I still don't mind you didn't like the book, but let's talk about it. So I'm still confident with my ideas. So your strengths and your weaknesses, I think, remain the same. Your life just gets busier.
Yeah.
And I have four children. They nip at my heels all the time. They're like four little Russian novels, you know, yipping around me. But success is sort of a, it's not as intrusive as you might think. It's not like, you know, fame as a, with a book is not like hunger or lust, or it's not an inner emotion. It's something that the outside world brings to you. Slightly puzzling, slightly pleasing, but ultimately you kind of just, you move on. You don't, you know, you can't really dwell on it.
Right, right. Well, as a fellow philosophy major and obviously a huge reader, I'm in love with these novels. We're drawing down on our time, but is there any last words of writerly advice that you can give? Most of our audience or most of our listeners are writers, so is there any advice you can pass along?
Well, I became a writer by being, first of all, a reader. I learned, I was moved by what other people had done with the written word. And initially, eventually I said, well, what if I can do it? Initially, I was terrible. I really was not a particularly good writer. It was mockishly laughable, the first things that I wrote. But I enjoyed the use of language. So I just kept at it. Another thing I'd say would be let go. You have to learn how to let go. You do your best. Everyone has at least one story to tell, their own. Once you've told that one, if you have nothing else to say, quit. And if you have something else, then you have to let go of that first story and move on to another one. Read widely, not just deeply, but widely, outside of your comfort zone. Read widely through time. I'm not particularly well-rooted in contemporary fiction, but I like exploring the classics. Right now I'm reading one I'd never read. I'm reading the Iliad in the Stephen Mitchell translation. So read, travel, open yourself, let go, listen to your mother, don't listen to your mother. Gosh, if there was a formula, I think we'd all be great writers. It's really, you have to be lucky. I've been incredibly lucky. You know, a book came out at the right time. You have to write without being attached to an end. Like, you can't write in the hope of being published, because that's kind of, it can in some cases be unlikely, and it's not the be-all and end-all. Ultimately, what's great about writing is you create something out of nothing, as in all the arts. Where there was silence, there's now music. Where there was a blank canvas, there's now paint. Where there was a blank page, there's now something. It's still, if you think of it, the vast majority of humanity disappears without leaving a single trace. Nothing. Nothing materially. They're lost to memory, everything. Whenever you create something in the arts, it remains. It'll be in someone's attic. Oh, my great-grandmother wrote this story, did this painting. And it's something. You've left your mark in the river of time. It'll float on the river of time forever. Whether it's appreciated by many or by few is not the point. You've somehow attained a little bit of immortality by creating.
Isn't that true? I think that is the great power of art, is that it does allow you to sort of leave something behind of yourself, and it is a little piece of immortality. I do think that's the power. Well, there's so many strengths and powers of writing, but I do think that's a great one. That's a great one. Jan Martel, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much. Congratulations.
My pleasure, Marie. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Wonderful. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Tessa Hadley will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, lots of stuff up there. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Tessa Hadley is the author of 6 highly praised novels, Accidents in the Home, which was longlisted for the Guardian First Book Award, Everything Will Be All Right, The Master Bedroom, The London Train, which was a New York Times notable book, Clever Girl, and now most recently, The Past. She is the author of 2 short story collections, Sunstroke and Married Love, which she was a New York Times notable book as well. Her stories appear regularly. I think she's the most, I think I read somewhere, she's the most published author, fiction author in The New Yorker. She lives in London and joins me from there now. Tessa, welcome.
Lovely to be talking to you, Marie.
Ah, thanks for coming on. So before we dive into this, I'm going to let you take us into the past. I'm going to let you talk about the book and sort of introduce us to the subject matter and the characters, and then we'll dive in and talk about it.
Okay. It's a book I was determined to write, a book that was just took place over a very short period of time. I think it was because my previous novel, Clever Girl, had covered 50 years of a woman's life. And I must have reacted to that because I thought, what I'd love to do is one of those really slow-burning, intense novels that just unfolds over a few days. So I mostly, that is exactly what I did. So I gather together four middle-aged siblings in the middle of the English countryside in the west of England, with a beautiful summer, and they are gathering in this home, which means everything to them because it was their grandparents' home. Their grandfather was the minister in the church next door, and it was their mother's home where she grew up, and she is now dead, and her long, sad shadow of that death sort of hangs over their adult lives. And they have vivid memories from many childhood summers and holidays spent there. So they gather there, and partly they're gathering to see whether they will have to give it up because the roof's falling in, there's no central heating, the walls are damp, it's expensive, they don't use it that much. But of course, that's a melancholy and difficult decision for them to make. And so they gather together, and then, of course, what I had to do to make things happen in that tranquil-seeming kind of circumstance, I have to drop some new people in. So the brother brings with him his new third wife, a very glamorous, confident, polished Argentinian lawyer none of the others have met her before, and she proves to be that sort of extra ingredient in the family mix which changes everything.
Isn't that great? I always feel like there's what the book is about from a plot perspective, and then there's what the book is really about and what was really on your mind and what questions have plagued you as a writer and as a woman. So what were you thinking about in terms of what the book was really about, what you were kind of emotionally exploring?
Well, you know, I think I actually always begin with story rather than themes. Of course, I mean, I'm inside it, I can recognize there are certain themes. I am fascinated by families and how they love each other and hate each other, and how they are painful to belong to and impossible to get away from. So that is one of my themes. I'm sort of fascinated with people at that mid-moment of their lives when they are half weighing up what they've done or failed to do and what's to come. And what other themes do I have? Well, I have two little children in the book who are exploring the world. The adults all want to protect them from it, of course, and keep them safe and make everything lovely. And what is it that the children are honing in on immediately? Well, they go to this ruined cottage they find in the woods. They're not supposed to go inside, but they do, and they find sex and death inside. They find a horrible stash of grimy pornographic magazines that somebody's left there, which are quite inexplicable to the children. Why are there all these naked women? And they find a dead dog, and they sort of hover around these mysteries in a mixture of horror and need to know. We need to know this stuff. So, those are some of my themes, but it was the story, it was the gathering and the slowness of the summer days, and then this painful thing that's at the center of the novel, alongside the children finding their way into new kinds of knowledge and other stuff. There is passion, I suppose, that strikes up between the rather repressed oldest sister, Harriet, who is a little bit inhibited and stiff and solitary and has thought that sex and sexual love and passion have nothing to do with her, and is smitten inexplicably out of the blue when she inadvertently eavesdrops on her brother making love with his new wife, and she just falls for this new wife. She's never loved a woman before. It hasn't crossed her mind. And suddenly this happens, and it sort of devours her and destabilizes her. So I don't know. I don't know if there are themes in all of that. It's the stories. That's what I start with. I think, what if that happened? What if in that setting this befell somebody? What would that mean? And my themes kind of come to me through story rather than thinking up the story to fit my themes, if that makes sense.
Right. That does make sense. And it's funny because the first half hour was Jan Martel was on, and it was exactly the reverse. It was
okay. Oh, how interesting. So he sort of has his idea, and then he thinks what story will work to tell that idea.
Yeah, right. So that's wonderful that you're on together to talk the two sides perfect. Of this. I really like. And your description of the older sister eavesdropping on the older brother making love to the new wife, I had read was the point of entry of this story for you, that came to you first and the novel kind of unspooled around that.
Yeah. And I have no idea. Those little visions, I just don't know where they come from. They erupt from somewhere deep in one's imagination inexplicably. I don't really know what it means, but I suppose, what is eavesdropping, voyeurism? It's that moment when you seem to see through an entrance into a bigger, fuller life beyond the one you have, and it fills you with sort of desire and hunger and disappointment all headily mixed together. Very potent. I had it in my imagination when it came to me. It was like a shot from a film. I saw it filmically and visually rather than being able to explain it. And the whole novel did begin from there, actually.
And actually, it's a very visual novel. I mean, I saw it so clearly as well. It did feel more like a film scene than because there are mirrors and shadows, and it was very cinematographic or whatever. That's not a word.
Okay, that's really good. I love it that you say that because that's sort of how I always need to know where the light is. It's funny, and when I'm looking at student work, I often say, hang on, but how could he see that her hair is blonde? Because it's dark, you know, and I'm very aware of the light sources and how light it is and how, I don't know, that ineffable thing inside a room. If you could see my room now, actually, where I'm sitting, because although I think you're in the middle of the day there, it's nightfall here, and there's the most beautiful cloudscape outside the window with these dark grey clouds and this pale sky above. That's so much part of this moment. That's what I always feel. Every moment, it's not just the transaction in the foreground that matters. It you have to kind of fill in the space it takes up and the way the air is moving around it. But for me, and there are writers who don't do that at all, who I completely love. You know, it's as if each writer has a different temperament and brings in a different range of sensual elements into a given moment in a book.
And that point of shadow and light is so important in the cottage when the children are discovering the dog, that it's everything is in shadow and everything's slightly revealed.
Yeah.
And the light falls on things in certain ways. So, and now that I'm thinking about your novel, you're right. Light is a very important what is revealed and what is kept in the shadows, both metaphorically and literally, is really wonderful.
You're right, of course, that it's metaphoric too, just the way light is. It's a thing, a practical daily reality, but it's always got a sort of metaphorical dimension. It's about seeing and what you see and what's hidden and what's half hidden, which is what writers are usually most interested in.
Very interesting. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And what I really loved about this was the layers of lost innocence. Of course, you have the children losing their innocence in the cottage, but you also have, this woman who's falling in love with a woman for the first time is another loss of innocence, and she'd really been sexually repressed this whole time. And it's just layers of loss of innocence and layers of coming into your own and grappling with that, you know, new understanding of what has been revealed to you, I think, is really the power and strength of
this. Yes, and I think whereas the story of children, as it were, losing their innocence is really quite a familiar pattern in books and in experience, it doesn't stop being deeply interesting. But the idea of somebody who's carried her innocence in some sense into her 50s, or she's 50, I think, and then loses it. Oh, gosh, how painful, how dreadful. I wanted us to feel really equivocal about that. I don't think we wish it not to have happened. How can you wish not to have lived, you know, not to have been deeply alive? But at the same time, it's pretty dreadful. Yeah. And there must be a bit of the reader, I hope, that thinks, if only she'd just gone on just coping and being fine and living that sort of dry surface. I think we should feel equivocal about it. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I would hate my book to be nostalgic for anybody's innocence, because I don't think grown-up books should be. But feeling the loss of innocence is a very, very, you know, a very frightening thing. That's the truth of it.
And the loss of time, you know, how much time she can't capture back is very interesting as well.
Yeah, that's right. It's fine learning about sexuality when you're nine, because
right.
you've kind of got plenty of time to get used to it and sane about it and manage it. Learning it about yourself in that way when you're 50 is, there isn't much time. It feels too late, to be honest.
There isn't much time, and your looks have, you know, whatever you feel about your aging process.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I feel like I need a drink now. I'm quite depressed.
Yes, I need one too.
You're closer to it than I. My guest this morning is Tessa Hadley. The book is The Past. And the other wonderful thing about this is just the place and time of the novel. It takes place in a house, and I think houses are so wonderfully metaphorical. And this house is too small.
Yeah.
Although it's a big house, it's too small for all of the occupants who are there now,
yes.
Which kind of puts
yes.
them on top
yes.
of each other and creates tension. So tell me a little bit about what the architecture of the novel gave you as a writer. Was it,
I love writing about houses. And again, actually, in reaction to the previous novel, Clever Girl, I think I moved my heroine, Stella, in Clever Girl from one house to one flat to one room to one house almost in each chapter, consciously, as time went on. I realized I was doing that, and that was meant to be a sense of her life that was episodic and that kept abruptly changing. And this time I, again, wanted the opposite effect, so that what I love in this family is that wherever they've all gone and whatever experiences all these siblings have had and however different their lives have been, there is this place built of stone, this rather lovely early 19th century rectory. It's not grand, it's not huge, but it's not tiny or pokey either. And there it persists, sort of as if their history and their past is embodied there, solid and actual, so they can move inside its rooms, which is what a house does for us. If we do keep connection with a house where our parents have lived or where our grandparents have lived, you have that extraordinary continuity that once I was in this room as a little girl, and now I'm in it as an adult, and yet the walls are the same, but are they the same? I love those questions. I think ever since I was a child, I've been slightly obsessed with family history and places that contain history. In our house, which we had in Cardiff, in my married life, it was the last house I lived in, there was a cupboard on the top landing, which, if you opened it, inside was the original wallpaper from, I think, about the 1890s, and the original special wood grain paint that they used to use on their doors, on the inside of this cupboard door. And it was like a little snatch, a little time capsule, a sort of almost like an airlock through which you can't help feeling, although you know it isn't possible, that you could move into another time when that house had different people in it. So houses are just wonderful metaphors. We live inside the shells of the past, making our present lives inside them, and irresistible, really, for a writer.
Absolutely. And introducing the new characters into the old house. The other thing that was interesting about this novel is two of the characters are married, or partnered at least, whose partners are not there. And I thought that the off-scene characters in this novel were obviously informing the people who are on the scene, and how much thought you as a writer need to give to those kind of ancillary characters who aren't with us.
Yes. I mean, there's a couple of sort of there's a husband off scene. The younger sister is married, and her husband effectively is absent for the whole novel. that was a nice joke, if you like. I had that quite early on. I thought all the time she's missing him and angry with him because he isn't there and wishing he was there, and that's a nice little sort of running joke that I can have in the story. And then, I mean, more potently and more painfully, there is their mother, who, when I was first writing, I was quite sure that the whole of the novel was just going to be this 3 weeks in, let's say, 2012, I think it sort of is. And the past would be there just by reference. We'd be feeling the past all the time, but we wouldn't go there. And then at some point while I was writing, I kind of suddenly knew that wouldn't work, that there was something in the energy and the dynamic of the whole stretch of the novel that needed a triangulation point. It needed a something pegged outside of the present, and so I made this decision to drop back in the middle section into 1968, which is 40-odd years before where we are for most of the story, and suddenly we see those adult siblings, we see their dead mother, we see them as children, we see their mother as a young woman, and that, by doing that, of course, what I did, through the whole first section, she's dead and she's absent, and they don't talk about her very much, but she crops up all the time like a ghostly presence in their present lives. And then suddenly she's flesh and blood, and I don't know whether I don't know how much I knew that was going to be true, but as soon as I was writing Jill, who is the mother, she was so flesh and blood. She's actually the most fleshly, dynamic powerhouse of a person in the whole book, I think.
Yeah.
And it was funny that I had withheld her and thought I wasn't even going to do her. And then the moment I kind of opened the door and let her in, she took over. She is very dominating, very powerful. And how funny that, you know, 40 years later, even though she's actually long dead, long absent from the scene, she's still felt. And she actually has the very last word in the last line in the novel. I won't say any more than that. But
right. So. Yeah, it's the power of the mother. I love that.
Yeah.
You can't get away from them, no matter how you try.
You can't get away from them. That's absolutely right.
So you came to publishing a little late. You published your first novel at 46, and now you've had six novels, and you're so widely, and short story collections, and you're widely published in The New Yorker. So tell me a little bit about your relationship with writing before 46.
I wish it was a kind of happier and more glamorous story, really, and that I'd not tried and then suddenly just did it and got published straight away. But it wasn't. It was the usual story of trying and trying. And it's sort of still a little opaque to me why I failed for so long. But I did fail. I couldn't do it. And I don't know why. I'm a late developer. And it was in my 40s that I sort of stepped into that place where suddenly every writer who's written anything that just works, however small a scale, that will know that feeling where suddenly this is what I need to say.
Yeah.
This is what I sound like. This is who I am when I'm a writer. And it's a lovely feeling of sitting inside your own skin at last. But I'm afraid there were three or four novels before that, unpublished, and now returned to the earth from which they came. They're rotting somewhere in landfill, which just failed, which weren't me. I wasn't inside my own skin. I was trying to write like other people. I was overwhelmed with admiration for other writers, which I can't think is anything but a good thing, but it was sort of inhibiting, and I did it wrong for a long time, but that was as it had to be. I don't really regret that.
No, it
wasn't very nice at the time.
Yeah, I really draw a lot of inspiration from that story because, you know, I think it is sort of time a task and finding your voice and maturing. I know a lot of
older
writers.
And some people don't take that long, and some people take a long time. Yeah, and do you know what? Sorry to cut across you, Marie, but I think the perseverance is a huge part of it. And it isn't a virtue. It isn't being good to persevere or being tough or... It's actually being slightly insane, because why would you go on making up novels when the last one you wrote didn't work very well and that didn't make you very happy, and then you did another one and that didn't work very well? What makes you write the third novel? I can't account for that. It isn't healthy, but there you are.
Well, it sounds more like a compulsion to do the work and not a compulsion to be published, which I think is right.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, that's very well put.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully you do it because you just are compelled to do it and compelled to understand something about life and yourself. And, you know, publication is nice.
Yeah, that's it.
Especially about The New Yorker. Publication by The New Yorker is really nice. So that's...
it was like a dream, really. And it was amazing when that happened, because I had looked at so many story collections by all the writers I loved best, and I would see, you know, not as many people as you would think read The New Yorker in the UK. So I had never held a physical copy of it in my hand, but I'd looked at all those lists saying, so-and-so were published in The New Yorker, and I would think, well, that's a good magazine. And then one day I was in it. How incredible is that? It still feels incredible.
I love it.
It does.
I love it. We're drawing down on our time, but do you have last words of advice? I know you've said take long, hot baths if you have writer's block. So I'm going to start that.
Yes, that's true. I mean, relaxing and dreaming, it's a sort of double act. You have to relax and dream, and then you have to be very clever and very smart and work very hard. And if you can do both of those completely opposite things, well, keep going.
Keep going.
And with any luck, you'll become a writer.
I love it. I also read somewhere that you are in a Henry James book club, and I had never really thought of doing a book club just by one author, but I think that's a really nice idea to get really deep into someone's work.
Yeah. And, yeah. It's just lovely. We are just meeting at the moment, reading Wings of the Dove together, and you have so much space to say everything that needs saying. It's very joyous. There's some very lovely young people in there, and how intelligent and sensitive they are, and what we have a very good time. Yes,
it would be interesting it'd be interesting to have generations of people in the group to see the work from different perspectives. You know, of how you read it in your 20s versus how you read it in your 50s. You know, would be
yes, great. We do actually. We have somebody. We have a man in his 70s, and he brings this wonderful sort of melancholy and yearning to his readings, whereas the young people, I think you're absolutely right, the young ones are reading, how do I live? So how should we do this?
Yeah.
Which is what you read for in your 20s, sometimes rather dangerously, taking your advice from the novels that you read. Help! You just have to be very careful. Hope you read the right ones.
I was going to say, yeah, no Clockwork Orange for you.
or Madame Bovary, for that matter.
Bovary, right. That's hilarious. Tessa Hadley, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Lovely to talk to you.
This was great. That was Tessa Hadley. The book is The Past. You can also find her in The New Yorker, as I mentioned, but the book is out now and available in the United States. It was published last year in the UK. Complete delight. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until then, stay tuned for a little reggae coming up next, and thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.